Glad to have all of you with us for another day of Political Rewind. And once again, this is, and we're all in this together, edition of our show. Most of you out there are working out of your homes, out of your apartments. My hats do go off to, my hat goes off to those of you who are still out there in the workplace, the people I see at supermarket checkout counters, at coffee shops who are continuing to serve people, at whatever retail stores are still open. You are allowing us to occasionally escape from our houses and go out and do necessary work. And for that, we are, I think I can speak for a lot of people and say we're very grateful. But in the meantime, we're doing this show as we've been doing it all week. I'm at home in my studio office in Greater Decatur, and all of our panelists for the time being will be joining us by phone, for the most part from their houses as well. Before I introduce the panel, I just wanted to remind you, on Monday's show, I said that I thought this was one of those experiences where we should hear from all of you about how you're dealing with the coronavirus and the restrictions it's placed on your lives. And I invited you to email me. You can do that by writing to bnigut, B-N-I-G-U-T, at gpb.org. And I wanted to share with you just a couple of notes in a general way. I got a note from a family in town who said that they have a cleaning service that comes into the house, a person who comes in to do their cleaning. And they've asked that person to stop coming in, but they've made a point of saying they're going to continue to pay that person. And they invite the rest of us out there who do, in fact, use cleaning services, perhaps to do the same thing. I got another note from a woman who had been in the Netherlands with her daughter. They flew back into Hartsfield over the weekend, and she wanted to make sure we understood that the way Hartsfield was handling screenings from people coming into the country was they were doing it on board the planes. They were passing out forms to fill out. And if you indicated on your form that you'd been to one of the countries that had been targeted for particular outbreaks of coronavirus, you were then taken inside the airport for additional screening in a secure location. So I'm really interested in those stories, and again, invite you to connect with me at bnigut at gpb.org. All right. That all said, we're going to move ahead with the show today, and let me introduce our panelists. Jackie Gingrich Cushman joins us today. She, of course, is a conservative writer, a columnist, an author, and I think, Jackie, that you are coming to me from your... Jackie's looking around for a copy of her book. I'm watching her on Facebook Live, so I can see that. Or not on Facebook Live, on FaceTime.
I know, but I thought I'd make you laugh about that. But no, I'm glad to be with you, and I am calling from my home in Atlanta, and of course, my husband's working from home, and both of our children are also now learning from home. So we're all here.
And well, yes, and if you find a copy of the book, unfortunately, we can't show it to our listeners today. The people who are watching on Facebook Live know that they can hear the show on Facebook, but unfortunately, we don't have video. We can see each other because we're doing a group FaceTime call. Greg Bluestein is part of that FaceTime call. He, of course, is the political reporter, one of the political reporters, the lead political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I see on my FaceTime live that, Bluestein, you're sitting in a space in your house with two baseball photographs behind you.
Oh, yeah. I'm in my man cave in my basement, surrounded by my doodads, my Braves autographs, and my PlayStation and my flat-screen TV, where I'll be working for the next couple of weeks.
Is that Henry Aaron behind you in one of those pictures?
Yeah, I've got DiMaggio, Aaron, King Griffey Jr., I've got Chipper Jones, I've got some of my favorite players. I collected them since I was a kid, so didn't think we could talk about baseball.
But all of them keeping you company, and we're glad you could do the show today. In a little while, I'm going to ask you what it's like to be a reporter trying to cover politics under these circumstances. Before I do that, let me introduce our final panelist. Mary Margaret Oliver, State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver of Decatur, joins us by phone today. Mary Margaret, where are you calling in from?
Good morning. I'm at home here with my hound dog, Henry. We are relaxing this morning.
Mary Margaret, let me start with you. Tell me, give us, if you would, how are your constituents talking to you about what's going on, about their concerns? Are they feeling comfortable, by the way, about the way that the government, whether it's federal or state, is handling this emergency? Just give us a sense of what you're hearing from your constituents.
As I leave the home, the ways which we're only supposed to leave, to go outside, to take a walk, to go to the dog park, to go to the grocery store, and I have gone to the law office where there's only three or four people this week. They're concerned about the economy. We are all talking with each other about what's going to happen next, the economy. Will a $1,000 check to each of us make a difference? What is the state budget going to look like by the end of the year? Can we predict anything? No one this week has been talking particularly about the presidential election, which is of interest to me. Mm-hmm. My colleagues down the Capitol are talking about concerns they have at home about medical supplies, about how there is a growing apprehension that our medical needs are not going to be made. Here at home, it's, I guess, because I'm in the middle of an Emory community, a medical community, people I see frequently are associated with CDC and the big $8 billion Emory healthcare institutions. They are focused more on the economy than the healthcare. They're kind of in the middle of the healthcare system, many of them, recognizing that things are very different.
And Jackie, you're pretty much sequestered at home like the rest of us as well, but what are your neighbors, how are you, what are kinds of conversations, whether it's by telephone, whether it's by text messaging or whatever, what are the kind of conversations going on in your neighborhood in your social community?
Well, we've got a couple of things going on. First of all, personally, as you know, listeners may or may not know, my father and his wife, Calista, are in Rome, Italy. So they're about, we're guessing, what, between 5 and 10 days ahead of us in terms of what's happening. He's been very vocal, writing and tweeting about what he sees and calling for a sense of urgency for us to go ahead and do what we're doing, which is to physically distance ourselves as much as possible from each other. So there is some concern there. My sister, who lives in South Florida, has rheumatoid arthritis. So she is on Enbrel, which is a biologic, which lowers her immune system. So I have some concern about her. And I think a lot of us have, you know, everyone either, you know, has lower immunity, or they're different of age, or they have someone they love. So there's a lot of concern and a lot of understanding that we need to do this. But I also have found, for instance, my sister's village of Key Biscayne 2 days ago declared a curfew. And the reason they did that is because they have a lot of older people in the community, they also have a lot of young people who were still going on the beaches and congregating all hours of the night. And so since people weren't taking it seriously and weren't deciding to pull themselves back, they decided to institute a curfew to make sure that people, you know, weren't out gathering. So I think it widely varies depending on who you are. But I think for most people, there's so much unknown. It's just almost hard to comprehend.
We should point out, of course, that your dad is Newt Gingrich, the former congressman from Georgia, the former Speaker of the U.S. House. And Calista was appointed by President Trump to be ambassador to the Vatican. As you point out, Jackie, your dad has been tweeting pretty regularly, cautioning officials in the United States that based on what he's seen around him in Rome, we've got to act with more urgency. At least one of the tweets that I saw from him was an effort to give the Trump administration some support, to say to them, you're doing your best, we know, to give them some support, but also, I think, pretty clearly suggesting that we'd better get tougher to try to deal with the problem here, right?
Absolutely, and I think he's also trying to, for those that are still saying this isn't a problem, which there are some people out there, unfortunately, saying, oh, this is just a made-up, right, just a made-up event, he's saying, no, this is actually, I'm living somewhere and watching this happen. This is real. And so the sooner we take it seriously and the sooner we take concrete steps, the better off we'll be.
So, Greg, it was interesting to hear Jackie talk about a Florida community which has imposed a curfew. You're a University of Georgia graduate. You pay a lot of attention out there to what's going on in Athens and Clark County. It's interesting that the other night the Athens-Clark County Commission imposed some of the most strict regulations in terms of the virus, banning any gatherings in restaurants, bars, public spaces, including on streets in residential neighborhoods larger than 10 people. They were looking at and considering the possibility of a curfew, but decided not to go in that direction. Nevertheless, Greg, Athens-Clark County is starting to take pretty serious action.
They are, and a commissioner tweeted this morning that it's not off the table there, too, so they could still end up doing that. I think a lot of communities might take the same steps, because what we're seeing is in other states, governors are closing down bars and restaurants and ordering some of these restrictions, and even in some places shelter at place, like in San Francisco, the Bay Area. Governor Kemp has so far balked at that. He says we're not there yet, but that's where city and county officials step in. And the mayor of Atlanta banned gatherings of more than 50 people. You just mentioned Athens, how they're taking their own restrictions in their own hands. And I think that we're going to start seeing that all over the state, especially in places where there is a sort of a mini hotspot, an epicenter of outbreak, where they feel like they need to take stronger restrictions than the state has taken.
Hey, Mary Margaret, Catherine Toomey was on our show, the Commissioner of Public Health, yesterday for about a half hour. And that was one of the questions I asked her. I said, is Governor Kemp now looking at taking an action much like Cuomo in New York, which is to, in fact, ban most gatherings of people, more than 10 people at a time, and, in fact, to perhaps make a statewide effort to shut down as much as possible social interaction. She said that they were looking at it but hadn't gone in that direction yet, and he confirmed this morning on a show that he did, a radio show he did in another community, that they're not quite there yet. Would you urge the governor to start looking at this as a statewide problem that needs to be addressed?
It's a statewide problem in different ways. First of all, Governor Kemp and all of us are very fortunate, I think, to have Dr. Toomey help us through this very serious medical crisis that we're facing. I think her credibility with all kinds of certainly bipartisan political leaders is very important. I feel myself, and I feel it in my Decatur high restaurant, high entertainment, the economy of Decatur, that people are just not out. I don't see people out. There seems to be, hour by hour, as I view it, a greater level of compliance. I think Athens is unique and could probably benefit from some stronger leadership. We have to realize how diverse Georgia is and how people's patterns of living are so different. So I'm not urging the governor to take any more aggressive action this morning. I certainly believe that tomorrow could be different.
Let me go over the headlines of today in terms of coronavirus and then ask each of you to weigh in on them. So give me just a moment to do that. As of yesterday at noon, we had 146 confirmed cases, which is up 25 from Monday. Catherine Toomey on our show yesterday said, do not be surprised as that number starts to spiral upward by large numbers. There's been one death. We've had cases mostly in Metro Atlanta, the largest concentration, but we've also had them around the state, Polk, Barrow, Charlton, Columbia, Richmond County, and others. We've now had, according to the governor's office, 420 people tested. And let's go to that, Greg Bluestein. 420 people tested in a state our size, and especially when many of those people are being confirmed as having the virus, We have a long way to go. And Toomey made that clear yesterday in getting test kits out so that public health centers around the state can deal with this virus, Greg.
We have a very long way to go on that front. 146 confirmed cases so far, you know, before noon today when there'll be a bigger number. But we have a very long way to go. It's why state officials are saying that even people who have low-grade fevers, who are otherwise feeling pretty healthy, shouldn't go rush out and try to get tested. They're saying call medical professionals first, but we feel like we're behind the curve on the testing issue. It's one of the things that we've assigned a team of reporters just to focus on testing at the AJC because it's becoming such an enormous issue. And the state, you know, is praising the fact that there's 500 more testing kits coming up, but that's still such an small drop in the bucket in terms of our total population. And really, it's an issue that's happening in other states too. You're hearing about a lack of testing, a lack of preparation from the federal government, getting tests available to places where we knew this was going to happen. Jim Galloway was out in Tolliver County the other day, and they're hoping to get 5 test kits for their little community. You know, they feel like they're immune because they're so far off the map. You know, they're such an isolated community. But the truth is, this is going to touch our lives in ways we can't even comprehend. And so that's why these hospitals are scrambling to prepare for this.
Jackie, one of the issues about not having enough test kits out there is it's very difficult to really know where the virus is and how widespread it might be. Now, that said, to me yesterday on our show, and certainly others have emphasized here in Georgia and across the country, that not everybody does need to be tested for coronavirus. Even people who are not in high-risk groups who may show some of the symptoms are not being urged at this point to try to get tested. Nevertheless, Jackie, without testing, on a broader scale, it's very difficult to know where the virus exists and how it's spreading.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Bill. And I think since we don't know that, I think the assumption has to be made. Again, this is what we talk a lot about. They talked yesterday about physical distancing. Originally, we talked a lot about social, but I like the idea of physical distancing because we can still be social over technology. So we need that because we don't know where it is. And we don't know who has it. I think we should be very cognizant that anyone we come in contact with could potentially have it, which is why the 6 feet separation is so important when you're with people. And it's really important for us to continue to wash our hands and to do all the things that we're supposed to do, you know, get sleep, make sure that we're, you know, eating well, et cetera, because we don't know where the virus is. So I think without knowing, we have to assume that whoever we come in contact with might have it.
Mary Margaret, in terms of things like getting tests in, I know the state is out searching for protective gear for people who work in healthcare. And in fact, we now have a report from Sanjay Gupta at CNN that 9 medical staffers that are part of the Emory Grady medical community have been infected with coronavirus. So we know the state's trying to get that kind of protective gear. We know they're looking for test kits. We know the president has now said states should make their best efforts to get ventilators, respirators, other equipment that may be in short supply right now. All that said, you all passed the supplemental budget, the amended budget that takes us through June, which includes $100 million earmarked specifically for the coronavirus. What will that money be used for? And if there are many things that the money we can't acquire with some of that money, we're still behind the curve, behind the eight ball.
The $100 million, as you know, comes from the Rainy Day Fund. And the governor basically, instead of changing the revenue estimate, took $100 million from the Rainy Day Fund, which I think was the right step to take. We did ask what is this money going for, and most of us really have a sense of tension right now on our public health offices, particularly in the smaller counties. I think that bolstering our public health offices, bolstering the testing, going to the private market for whatever the medical supply needs, is going to be part of that money. But I will tell you, there's been a bipartisan support for Governor Kemp. I think there is a recognition, even though there's a less of a recognition in the Republican base, as we say, that this is a crisis. I think there's been a bipartisan leadership recognition that this is a crisis. And I think that Governor Kemp will be obligated to and will detail as we go forward how this $100 million is going to be spent. We're also, we're only talking about supplemental budget between now and June 30th. So I think that is hopefully an adequate resource for the state to do some emergency responsiveness. And when we come back, our task to finalize, which is our only real duty that we have, when we come back to work, to finalize our budget that starts July 1st, we're going to have a reduced revenue estimate for 2021 budget. We're going to have some serious economic questions and some data in front of us. So the Rainy Day Fund will be drawing our attention again in the estimate at this point.
I should point out, by the way, in talking about test kits, I got a note from Cody Hall, the governor's press secretary, who pointed out, they're starting to use private providers of testing kits. Mm-hmm. Quest Diagnostics, Cody tells me, is delivering 500 test kits to Department of Public Health warehouses today. And what they're hoping to be able to do is send those kits out to district public health offices around the state sometime in the next 24 hours, probably. But Greg, all that said, we're still short of tests. But, Mary Margaret made an interesting point, Greg. The fiscal year budget begins July 1st. We all know, those of us who've covered the Capitol for many years, know how complicated the process of passing a new budget can be. If they can't get back into session in the weeks ahead, what do we know about the safeguards built into being able to start spending on a budget that hasn't been approved by July 1st?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And lawmakers I've talked to are keeping their fingers crossed, hoping that they can be able to get in. There's no way to remote vote, or else they would have done it Monday, right? Most of the lawmakers in the Capitol on Monday wanted to be anywhere but there, voting on something that ended up taking 7 or 8 hours to vote on.
Yeah, they came. Let me just make clear what you're talking about. On Monday, the legislators were called back into a special session to vote on the governor's request to have emergency powers. Go ahead.
You got it. And it was supposed to be a short vote. It ended up being a very long day. That being said, there is obviously a way that lawmakers can communicate with each other without being in the same room. So I'm sure that if that happened, there could be remote meetings and remote conversations, just like the governor has been doing with the press since this pandemic began to spread. As the law is written now, they need to be in the same room, in the same physical space, to vote and to pass these things, these major bills out. So it's gonna prompt a lot of these discussions all over the nation, because we're not the only Georgia legislature, the state legislature, that had to suspend its duties. Right now, from what I hear from state officials, is they're hopeful that lawmakers could come back in a month or two, but there is the chance that they won't be able to. And in that case, we might see a stopgap budget. Maybe something that could be later amended later on this year to keep the government running, but might not be the exact blueprint to keep the government running for a full year. Maybe just for a couple months.
Bill, this is Mary Margaret again. I really, my guess is that we will not come in before May 19th. That's my guess. I think we'll come in
being the date of the primary.
The date of the primary. My guess is we'll come in after May 19th. My guess is, and I'm kind of leaning that this is what I would urge the governor to do at this time, to come back not for the 10 days we have left in our 40-day session constitutionally, but come in for fewer days and pass the budget and adjourn. If the trajectory of this disease virus goes as experts tell us it's going to go, even with the efforts we're making, we're in for a serious medical crisis the next 2 to 6 weeks. And that takes us right into May. So projecting and guessing about all this is all we can do right now. But my concern, my thought is pass a budget, see where we are economically mid-late May, and go home.
Let's do this. Thank you for that, Mary Margaret. Jackie, Greg, Mary Margaret, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more. We've been talking about the state. Let's talk a little bit about this really, I think, important change of tone coming out of the White House from the president the last couple of days and what it might mean as we move forward with dealing with this crisis. And then let's talk, yes, about politics. We've had three primaries last night, and we should talk about those. And we have a new AJC poll on how people are feeling about the Democratic presidential contest and one of the two state Senate races. So we'll look at those issues and more. But first, let's pause for these messages. Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have Mary Margaret Oliver, Greg Bluestein, Jackie Gingrich-Cushman with us on the show today. And, of course, as we're doing on every show during this emergency that we're dealing with, they're joining us by telephone, which means, you know, the audio isn't maybe the best in the world, but you know what? What they're saying is as good as it always is. Jackie, let me start with you on this, because you are you identify yourself, I think, as a Trump supporter. I mean, you've taken issue with him at times, but for the most part, I think it's safe to say you're a Trump Republican. This shift in the president's tone the last few days, his sudden apparent understanding of how serious this is, first of all, would you agree with my premise that he has made a shift in tone? And second, if so, are you relieved that he has?
Well, I do think he's changed his tone, and I think more importantly, which I think makes sense for what's happening, if he's kind of stepped back a little bit and let some of the health professionals answer a lot of the questions and take a lot of the, take kind of their lead in some degree more than determining things himself, which I think makes a lot of sense. But I think it is a really challenging time just because we don't have a roadmap to where this is going to go. And I think you're kind of watching him change his tone and tactics as things unfold.
Mary Margaret, I think there are a lot of people who have noticed that change of tone. Certainly there are critics out there who believe that changing the tone is a good step, but that there are an awful lot of things the federal government has not yet stepped up to the plate to deal with. But we are at a point where people are sort of, after having been locked in our partisan corners, people are beginning to recognize that we've really got to somehow pull together for all of this. So how do you balance that in terms of President Trump and how the federal government is responding right now, Mary Margaret?
It's a dramatic different tone from Trump. President Trump, like all politicians, but he more visibly so, is more a active participant in his reelection. And I think that he has come to be listen, the people are telling him, this is a very serious matter and is going to impact your reelection. Maybe for the first time he's listening to communications, PR people, or maybe for the first time he's really been, I don't want to use the word humbled, but it might be an apt appropriate word, humbled in terms of the seriousness of what he's facing. Turning it over to the medical experts has been a little bit hard for him to do on the TV. It's been mainly him and Pence. Dr. Fauci has been a very, very strong voice, though. And I think people are listening to everything they're trying to hear, everything that's trying to be put forward. And more bipartisan than not, in our world of bipartisan political life, more bipartisan than not, we are all trying to figure out what is going to be the world next week.
Greg, here's my take on this. I'm curious what your reaction is. I think to some extent, the people, whether it's the campaign people or folks around him in the White House itself, are basically saying to him, Mr. President, your reelection is not going to take place in October and then up November 3rd, right? Your reelection is at stake right now. In other words, they're telling him, this is the moment in which you step up and show us that you deserve four more years. Do you think that take is accurate?
I agree. I mean, look, his advisors had banked on two things coming just a month ago. One was a strong economy, and the second was a liberal opponent. And both of those seem out the window right now. Joe Biden is essentially locked up the nomination, and the economy is well, I'll put it this way, the nation needs to do everything it can to avert an economic catastrophe. So he is forced to recalculate everything. And if you look at, I mean, I was just with him in Atlanta a couple of weeks ago where he was talking about how he was still going to hold major rallies and still shake people's hands, and how quickly the world and his words have changed since then is staggering to me. And he sees that this is a, it seems like he sees that this is a dire threat to the nation's economic future. And of course, to hundreds of thousands of residents who could fall ill to this disease. So you're starting to see him kind of step up to that sober reality.
So let's talk about electoral politics for a little while on the show today. And Greg, you've got the ball. Let me keep it with you. And let's start by talking about the move of the primary from March 24th, just next week, to May 21st. May 19th, right?
Yep.
So, Greg, one of the questions there is going to be that Brad Raffensperger's office is now saying, we've already heard them say we want to get absentee ballot applications out to senior citizens primarily so they don't have to face any of the possible dangers of going into a polling place where there still could be virus being spread. But now they're talking about a much broader effort. They haven't confirmed they're doing it for sure, but they're exploring whether they should be sending absentee ballot forms out to virtually all the registered voters in the state and transferring the whole election basically to absentee balloting. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the options they're exploring. That is complicated to not just the cost of that, but also, of course, counting it. I mean, there's a question that in the next weeks and months, if there'll be even the county officials able to count those ballots. So there's a host of issues, but look, when you looked at when you watched CNN or Fox News last night and you saw the long lines of voters in Chicago who are all 6 feet apart, the limiting of voting machines in many of these precincts because they wanted to keep social distancing exercised, you can see the disaster that could have unfolded next week in Georgia had we continued our election without hand sanitizers in a lot of these polling sites, with more than 300 poll workers who had already called in sick and said that they wouldn't be able to do it because on average, the age of poll workers in Georgia is either 70 or 72, depending on the calculation. So you can definitely see why Georgia took the steps to take. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy to even hold an election in 2 months from now. But you kind of saw what could have been the story of next week last night when you were watching the primaries in other states.
Jackie, and one of the issues here is there's nothing that tells us that by May 19th this is going to be a done deal, that we're going to be back to normal. In fact, we're beginning to hear more and more people speculate, and I mean informed people in the public health community speculate that this could go on well into the summer. So May 19th may not be as safe a date as the Secretary of State would like it to be, Jackie.
Well, it may not, and we don't know. What we do know is a couple of things. One is that, if you want to get an absentee ballot and plan ahead, that might be a good idea. Two, if you, we might want to think about for the state, should we try to find poll workers from a different age group and ask other people that are interested in helping out the community volunteer? I also think that the more we do physically distance, and again, I'm going to use physical distance as opposed to social distance because I think people need that emotional connection, especially right now. But if we can maintain, if we can all encourage people to get that physical distance between each other, then that will help us, get back to normal sooner. But we don't know it's the real answer.
Mary Margaret?
I wonder if we'll change our early voting.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me? Can
yep.
you hear me,
yep.
Bill? Will we change our early voting pattern? I mean, can we change so that people can just vote whenever they want to spread out the voting? Again, we are in such, we all are saying this, but it, the reality of it is becoming significant. We don't know what next week will look like, and we certainly don't know what mid-April or mid-May will look like. The fact that the presidential primary is over as a practical matter, the fact that people's attention is really diverted to the day-to-day unusual lives we're now living, I think helps a little bit. I'm glad that next week Georgia was not a pivotal primary, given where we are in the presidential primary race. The presidential race in the next 60 days is just going to take a back burner. Mm-hmm. We have other small races around. We, you know, we have a sheriff's race in DeKalb. That's an important position, not an earth-shaking attention to it. But there are some other elections that are happening, too.
So, Greg, let's talk about election politics in Georgia. The AJC just yesterday released a poll from the University of Georgia School of Public and International Affairs, the contractor you use now for that. Let's talk about the Senate race, and we're gonna turn to what that poll shows us about presidential in a few minutes. But let's start with the U.S. Senate primary. And we're talking now about Senate race number one, which is the Democratic race to fill, to try to compete against David Perdue in the general election. Do you have the numbers in front of you?
Yes. And I can launch right in. It shows that John Ossoff leads the field with about 31% of the vote, which is a big number. Sarah Riggs Amico and Teresa Tomlinson trail at both about 15%, 16%, so they're statistically tied. But the biggest number is 39%, and that is the number of undecided voters just 2 months out. So that's a pretty high proportion of folks who are still up in the air 2 months out before the May 19th primary, where we're supposed to vote. Folks are supposed to vote on this race. And it shows, A, how much this race has been overshadowed by the Kelly Loeffler, Doug Collins, Raphael Warnock, special election that won't be until November. There's no primary for that one. But B, it also shows how hard it will be for these candidates to try to get attention, energy, momentum, enthusiasm, while they're also, while the public is wrapped, is captive, essentially, to coronavirus. When the presidential race is barely in the headlines, let alone down-ticket contests like Senate races and House races, and this is a challenge for all Georgia candidates to try to sort of elevate themselves and to get attention and to get voters' energy behind them while we're dealing with an unprecedented public health crisis.
Mary Margaret, what do you make? I know you're a Teresa Tomlinson supporter and have been from very early on. The fact that Ossoff has a fairly wide margin lead at this stage, had voting, by the way, taken place next week, it would have been interesting to see how that all might have played out. But 39% undecided, Mary Margaret, really tells you that folks have not, as Greg points out, focused on this race. My question is, how do these candidates get attention to make progress in competing?
There's some consultants that are really head knocking about that. I don't have much advice because it's two unusual times to make those calculations. John Ossoff, attractive young man with $30 million of money spent on name recognition not that long ago, I think would be predictably have greater name recognition in a high undecided race. Sarah Amico did also run a campaign recently. Teresa has not run a campaign statewide recently. I think that these numbers are not very helpful, certainly not determinative, and reflect the fact that people are not looking at that race in any real way yet, and that they might not have a good chance to do so between now and May 19th, given the crisis that's diverting us all. If I were advising any of these candidates, I would be hard-pressed to know what to tell them to do other than to go give blood where they are able to donate blood.
Jackie, you've been involved with political campaigns since you were probably 5-6 years old, campaigning at your dad's knee back when he was running for Congress. How do these candidates figure out a way in the midst of everything that's going on to get there. And not only is it the news that is shutting them out, but they can't hold rallies. They can't hold real, the kind of even smaller gatherings that typically a candidate going into a small town, say in South Georgia, would have at the local coffee shop or whatever. It's really making it difficult for these people. Do you do your whole campaign, Jackie, on social media?
No, I think you've got a point. And, you know, I did start very young. And at that time, we had no internet or any type of social connection. So it was all retail politics. It was all hand-to-hand going to, you know, strip centers and small, you know, barbershops and shaking hands, which, to your point, you can't do right now when you're trying to physically distance yourself from everybody. So really what you can do is you can use technology to try to reach those people in different ways. So my best advice would be for them to experiment with social media, with Facebook, et cetera, to try to reach the people and to have a message that resonates enough with people that they'll refer them to their friends. But Representative Oliver was exactly right. You know, it is very hard for, you know, it's not surprising that Ossoff is in the first position because he did have a lot of money spent for the race that he didn't win. And I think until we get closer to that election, it's going to be hard to see what happens.
Greg, there are some interesting crosstabs in this poll. Sam Bermisdaw has unpacked it for us. Amico does well among young Democrats, according to your polling. She received 14% of the overall vote. Poll numbers. 31% of those, though, are 18 to 29, said they would vote for her. What would account for that from your point of view?
And those are also the people who are least likely to, that's the age group that's least likely to vote, too.
Well, that's right. They may not vote.
Yeah. But, you know, I think part of it is the statewide campaign. She just ran 2 years ago. Part of it might be, you know, being on the same stage as Barack Obama and Stacey Abrams in so many events. So she does have that higher name recognition. You know, it's been interesting to me to see that. That number might have been one of the more surprising parts of the poll to me was because, you know, while John Ossoff and Teresa Tomlinson are duking it out for endorsements and from lawmakers and groups and high-profile officials, Sarah Riggs Amico really has not been in that part of the race. I mean, her campaign has not been trying to lock up or has not locked up a lot of these big-name endorsements or had these big events. It's a bit much more kind of lower-profile campaign, yet she's still right there in the thick of the hunt. So I think that's part of it, her enduring name recognition from 2 years ago, and same thing with John Ossoff, clearly. And it really will. It's going to be so fascinating for political scientists to study these races in a few years, because how folks who can't retail politics, who can't hold fundraisers, who can't canvass and knock on doors and do all the things that a campaign thrives on, can get attention to a down-ticket contest when Joe Biden is struggling to get attention right now in the media.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mary Margaret, one of the other quick cross-tabs I want to talk about, we got to get to a break, but before we do, this poll also, once again, indicates how important the African-American vote can be in a Democratic race. About 42% of Black Democrats polled say they're undecided about who to vote for in Senate race number one. So, once again, a key, crucial constituency for the candidates, Mary Margaret.
I don't think any. I think Teresa is a native Georgian and who has been more identified mid Georgia, rural Georgia, more uniformly identified across the state, may have a better chance to reach those voters. But you're right; they're key and they're not engaged yet at a higher level. They're less. They've identified a candidate less than the rest of the population has. I think this is such an unusual year, based on this virus, that it's impossible to know what the mood will be 6 weeks, 8 weeks from now.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, Greg, I said I'd mention it at the beginning. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show, so let me ask you, how difficult is your job as a reporter these days to cover all this? I mean, you can't go out anywhere. News conferences are being held by teleconference or whatever. How hamstrung are you?
Yeah, it's been a unique challenge because my wife is a healthcare executive, so she's got to be out. every day. She leaves the house every day to go to her hospital to help fight this disease. And so the kids are upstairs, sometimes with babysitters, sometimes with an in-law, sometimes with me. But you're right. Like, it's hard to, you know, yesterday I had about 20 questions to ask the governor, and it was a remote press conference where the best we could do is email them in or type them in on the WebEx. And, you know, he answered, he broadly answered one or two of them, but I've got about 18 more questions. And it used to just be able to raise my hand and try to do my best to, you know, get one in there. And now it's a lot harder. It's going to change a lot of the ways we do our jobs. And, you know, most importantly, from now my basement instead of from the state capitol or from whatever event the governor or state politicians are. And how do you cover a campaign if there's no campaigning?
All right, there you go. Good news for the governor's office. Greg Bluestein can't hound the governor in person to get answers to his questions. Let's get our final break out of the show out of the way. We'll come back, talk a little bit about what happened in Democratic presidential politics last night. We're coming to you, it's about 9:50-something in the morning, our live show on Political Rewind, the encore presentation, of course, at 2 in the afternoon. Real quickly, a big story just broke. President Trump has announced he has closed the U.S.-Canadian border to all but essential traffic for the time being. Okay, we'll get more on that as the day goes on, I'm sure. All right, real quick, Joe Biden won primaries in Arizona, Illinois, and Florida last night. He continues to roll toward the nomination, and now he's reaching out to Bernie Sanders supporters. Here's what he said in a presentation he made in an empty room by a video link to people who are his supporters.
Senator Sanders and I may disagree on tactics, but we share a common vision for the need to provide affordable health care for all Americans, reduce income inequity that has risen so drastically, to tackling the existential threat of our time, climate change. Senator Sanders and his supporters have brought a remarkable passion and tenacity to all of these issues. And together they have shifted the fundamental conversation in this country. So let me say, especially to the young voters who have been inspired by Senator Sanders, I hear you. I know what's at stake. I know what we have to do.
Greg, Bernie Sanders people are saying Bernie Sanders' campaign team is saying he's now going to take some time to assess the situation, decide whether to go forward. But Biden has got a big task ahead of him to try to attract the Sanders supporters to his side.
Especially younger voters. I mean, that's the one part of the demographic that he continually excelled at and continually beat Joe Biden is voters under 30, in some cases voters under 40. So he's got a big task ahead, United Party. But first, Bernie Sanders needs to decide his next step. We know from the results he would have to win about 60% of the remaining delegates in order to overtake Joe Biden in the delegate hunt. So, and that looks like virtually impossible. His chances of winning this are all but evaporated. But, you know, that same thing happened in 2016, and he stayed in the race till June. So you never know.
Mary Margaret, I was just going to mention that there are people who supported Hillary Clinton who still believe Bernie Sanders' refusal to drop out of that race when it was clear she was going to be the nominee cost her the White House. How concerned are you as a Democrat about his continuing in this race at this stage?
Unfortunately, I'm one of those people that feels that way, and I'm a little bit apprehensive. Does a 78-year-old white gentleman who has had one mode of operation for his entire successful political life, learn, able to change, able to adapt? Is Bernie willing to risk his legacy by making people feel again that he's hurting the chance to bring a Democrat back to the White House? That's the question I'm asking.
I apologize for interrupting. Jackie, I'm going to give you the last comment on this. Yes, Bernie Sanders' path is a difficult one, but you would know as well as anybody. He has been a passionate campaigner. To lose the way he's been doing recently is very personally difficult, traumatic. And so it does seem to me that people need to understand that winding down a campaign under these circumstances isn't easy, and he deserves some respect as he figures out what to do, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, I think he's going to think that. I mean, I think the whole thing is fascinating because, you know, he's a self-described independent on his Senate website, right, running for the Democratic, nomination. I think it, for the Democrat side, they absolutely should want him to get out so Biden can go ahead and focus on Trump. But, you know, I don't think Bernie's worried about that. I think Bernie's worried about, you know, his legacy is really rallying his troops, and I think that's what he's going to continue to do.
Jackie Cushman, you got the last word in the show. Greg Bluestein, Mary Margaret Oliver, thank you so much for dealing with the kind of unusual circumstances in which we present the show these days, but you all were wonderful as usual. And thank all of you out there for listening to another Political Rewind. We're back again with a brand new show tomorrow. See you then.